and have a great evening.
You're welcome to Straight Talk Africa, coming to you from my home in Arlington, Virginia, a suburb of Washington, D.C. I am Shaka Salee, and today we'll reflect on some recent major developments in the Republic of Sudan.
For the latest developments in the Republic of Sudan, I am joined by my colleague, John Tanza, host and managing editor of VOA's South Sudan in Focus radio program. I have to say, frankly, that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly gratified to have the opportunity to interact with you on this special edition of Straight Talk Africa.
The feeling is mutual, Shaka Salee. Thank you for having me.
You're most welcome. You know, it's been quite some time since the overthrow of President Omar al-Bashir from Khartoum. Give us an update. What's happening on the ground in the Republic of Sudan? There were so many promises made. To what extent have some of those promises been delivered?
I would start with the latest, being that there was a cabinet reshuffle 2 weeks ago. That's in line with the Juba Comprehensive Peace Agreement that was signed by the transitional government and various rebel groups fighting in Darfur and Blue Nile State. So the term of the agreement was dictating that the transitional government reshuffles the cabinet and forms a new one to include rebels who signed an agreement with the transitional government. That was done. Five women were also appointed in that cabinet, which is a record in the history of Sudan. And that is the latest, but the people who chased Bashir away are still on the streets demanding for change. They are saying they are not seeing all the pledges that were made by the transitional government to the people who, you know, struggled so hard to unseat Bashir. For instance, they are talking about the economic crisis. It's still difficult to put bread on the table in Sudan.
You know, as well as I do, that the transitional government promised the people of Sudan that it would immediately introduce what it characterized as social justice. How far, to what extent have they been able to deliver on that?
The people that I speak with in Sudan, journalists, analysts, and the ordinary old friends in Sudan, are still saying that they're not seeing any changes. If anything, the only change is that Bashir is not in power, but his lieutenants are still in control of the economy. For instance, they are saying the price of bread has actually tripled, you know, before it was at affordable price during Bashir's time, but it was not available. Now it's available, but the price have gone up. The price of gasoline has gone up, and transportation is a challenge. So the people are saying the promises made are yet to be fulfilled.
Wait a minute, John. How can you talk like that? You are talking as if, in fact, what we saw was a change of guards. These are people who actually said theirs was not a change of guard, but rather a fundamental change.
Correct. It depends on who you speak to. I interviewed a former state minister in the Ministry of Labor in Sudan, and he told me that the reason why he resigned is because Yes, the top executive from the people who brought change, the ministers and whatnot. But the technocrats in most of the institutions in Sudan are Bashir's loyalists. And so they could frustrate you if you want to bring change. And the case of the state minister was one. He said he was not able to work. You know, everything he wants to do is not recognized. So he decided to quit. So in essence, yes, there is a change of guard, but the technocrats, the people who have the know-how, are still, most of them are still Bashir's loyalists. This is what people are telling us from Sudan.
But what about the fact that the transitional government has at least succeeded in one major area? It succeeded, for example, in making sure that the name of the Republic of Sudan was removed from the United States list of countries that support or sponsor terrorism. To what extent has that been reflected on the ground? To what extent has that been, for example, welcomed on the ground and in the
region? Of course, there was a tremendous welcoming of that news by the ordinary people, because the ordinary people believe that when Sudan is lifted from the list of countries sponsoring terrorism, it means that U.S. companies will come and invest in Sudan. And once U.S. companies invest in Sudan, it translates into creating jobs for the ordinary people. Now, the politicians, the members of the transitional government of national unity, hail it as one of their landmark success, because this is going to give Sudan an opportunity to interact with the international community on equal footing. But the other, you know, quarters of the society, especially the Islamists, are not seeing it as victory, because they look at it like it's a surrender to the Americans, or to what they will call the infidels. And so these are what other analysts are telling us. For instance, the normalization of relations with Israel. The executive is praising it as a milestone, but the fundamentalists, the Islamists, are saying, wait a minute, you're supposed to have a parliament. It's the parliament to decide which country Sudan should normalize relations with, not the military or the transitional government. So that in itself is a problem there.
From your reporting, how has the domestic constituency, for example, reacted to the normalization of the relationship with Israel? And what about the African Union and the Arab League?
I would start with the Arab League. There was a little bit of, if you like, mute reaction from the Arab League. The Palestinians made noise that this is against what was agreed in 1947, that no Arab country should establish a relationship with Israel. The Palestinian authority came clear on that, but some Arab countries have been mute on that development. Back in Sudan, before the late leader of the Umar Party, Sadiq al-Mahdi, when he spoke to us, he said, that was a mistake by the transitional government of national unity, because the government has no mandate from the people to transact on behalf of the Sudanese people. Late Sadiq al-Mahdi said the transitional government should have waited for a parliament to be constituted, and then it's the parliament to decide which country Sudan should normalize its relationship with. Of course, the ordinary people, some people did not want to make their feelings known, but the Islamists were not happy because of their long-held hostility towards the state of Israel.
Well, on that note, Ndugu John Tanza, it was a pleasure interacting with you.
The feeling is mutual, Shaka Sali. I feel privileged to be on this show.
You're most welcome, sir.
Thank you, John, for that interesting report. And now joining me to discuss the recent developments in the Republic of Sudan
are two distinguished guests. Nurdin Sati, the Sudanese ambassador to the United States of America, and Temi Ablogba, program and research associate the Africa program at the center of international policy. Well, I have to say, frankly, Nuruddin and Temi, that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the two of you on this special edition of Straight Talk Africa.
We are honored also, Shaka. Thank you very much. It's an honor and a pleasure to be on your program. Thank you very much for the invitation.
Thank you for having us.
You're most welcome, Temi. Let's go to the important topic of the Republic of Sudan. You have had significant changes in your country, Ambassador Nuruddin. What are some of the major accomplishments so far by the Sudanese transitional government?
The major accomplishment, I would say that one of them actually took place only 2 days ago, trying to control our currency. You know that for so many years, Sudan had a dual system of currency exchange, and 3 days ago, the central bank took a very bold decision to unify the rate of exchange of the pound, the Sudanese pound, and this is, I understand, working very well, and this will help us to improve the performance of our economy and our financial systems. But of course, the most significant accomplishment for us for the time being has been resumption of normal relations with the United States, so the international community at large, and having Sudan removed from the list of countries harboring or sponsoring terrorism. I think that was a major achievement for Sudan. And building on that, we have opened up to international transactions, and now the American companies are welcome and available to work in Sudan. Another, of course, major achievement was signing a peace accord in Juba with a number of armed groups, which have now joined the government. A few days ago, we had a cabinet reshuffle in which a number of leaders of those armed groups joined the government. And I think this is another very significant achievement that will help us move forward.
To what extent would you say the most recent cabinet reshuffle looks like Sudan?
It looks like Sudan because it recognizes the diversity of the Sudanese people. It's also, whether it is from a regional, political, or ethnic point of view, linguistic point of view. And it helps us to address some of the major general challenges that have been with us, I would say, since independence, the issue of to be able to manage our diversity. This, for me, this has been really the major issue in Sudan. And now we are working on that. And I hope that this formula will help us now to turn to resolving other issues, such as the issue of governance, how are we going to rebuild and restructure the state, how are we going to do our nation building, and how are we going to be able to move together as one Sudanese people.
Tell me, I know that you pretty much monitor the developments across the African continent. To what extent would you agree with Ambassador Nuruddin about some of the major accomplishments that have been done or achieved by the Sudanese transitional government?
Yeah, I definitely agree with the points that the ambassador made. Definitely the removal from the state sponsors of terrorism lists was a major accomplishment for this transitional government because it's one of the promises that they made when they came into power. The removal from the list has allowed them to begin receiving international aid. At the beginning of January, the former U.S. Treasury Secretary announced that Sudan will begin to receive $1 billion annually for the World Bank. So that's a really strong strong example. And like he said, they've been allowed to rejoin the international community now, excuse me. So this includes things like receiving debt relief, increased foreign investment, and these are all things that removal from that list have been able to facilitate. So, you know, they are succeeding in accomplishing those promises they made when they came into power. And then, of course, in terms of bringing democracy and peace, you know, the agreement that was made between the transitional government and the coalition of rebel leaders in South Sudan, you know, with the promises of ending devastating wars in Darfur, Blue Nile, and other places, you know, is definitely a very strong move. You know, some weaknesses or worries experts have is that maybe, you know, the lack of international help and also trying to promote democracy in the middle of intersecting crises may be very difficult, but nonetheless, it still should be something that they consider an accomplishment.
To what extent have some of those major accomplishments, Nuruddin, been, for example, welcomed by the vast majority of the Sudanese people on the ground?
No, they have certainly been welcomed with a lot of enthusiasm by the people, because these are parts of the what the people have been calling for so many years. So the people are really very happy about those changes, certainly. But this does not mean that there are not other serious concerns concerning the economy, for example, and the livelihoods of the people. That's another issue that we are grappling with. And we are hoping that the decision taken 3 days ago will help us achieve the objective of improving the livelihoods of the people.
How do you reconcile that view with criticism emanating from people that are characterized as Islamists, as saying that the transitional government really has pretty much sold out to the Americans, especially when we talk about the normalizing of relations, which of course resulted in your country's removal on the list of the U.S. countries who sponsor or promote terrorism?
Well, I do not see it that way. Not sold out. Actually, I see it the other way around. I see the U.S. Is supporting the legitimate, call for peace and justice and democracy and freedom in Sudan. There is an alignment of values between us and the United States and the international community. And this alignment of values has been absent for so many years, for 30 years under the Islamists, because they wanted to take us, the society, and actually the Muslim world in the wrong direction. Mm-hmm. So we are not being selling to anybody. All that we are doing, we are reaffirming our own values, and those values tally with those of the Americans and the international community. And that's why we are very comfortable about what we are doing, and we'll continue on that path.
Let's go back to the late 1990s, when your country was accused for having aided Osama bin Laden and his colleagues for bombing the United States embassies in Kenya and Tanzania, when the United States reacted by bombing a facility that later turned out to be a pharmaceutical facility or factory. Has that, for example, been taken care of by the United States? Have they admitted that it was a mistake?
And yes, they have.
And to what extent have they, in fact, been able to compensate you?
Yes, they have. They have been, it has become a court case, and the owner of that facility went to court, and the court system has found him, gave him on the right side, and this matter has been closed quite early through the legal system.
Tell me, The ambassador talks about normalizing of relationships with Washington, and he in fact adds about normalizing relationship with Israel. How has that played in the region, for example? Because you know as well as I do that there is an outstanding policy of the African Union and the Arab League, rather, on how to deal with the issue of the Palestinians and the state of Israel.
Yeah, so in terms of the region and how Africa is perceiving these policy changes, you know, Hamdok, himself believed that, you know, requiring the normalization of relations did have the potential to unravel Sudan's democratic transition. You know, when they were making this decision, they were quite worried about how the people may react, because there was this perception that the U.S. may be forcing Sudan's hand rather than an organic agreement between two countries that was agreed on by popular mandate from the Sudanese people and the government, therefore representing the people's interests. And internationally, the same belief is held. Within Africa, though, it's clear that the Israeli PM is, you know, really has his sights set on Africa, because now Morocco is normalizing ties as well. And he sought to develop ties with multiple African states. So in terms of how African nations are viewing Israel when it comes to policy, you know, they're observing the potential economic benefits of renewed and closer ties. And they're also, you know, looking at the fact that, you know, the Israel is showing interest in them, so maybe how they can wager in this, you know, foreign policy playground.
Ambassador Nuruddin, what about the issue of Jerusalem as the capital of the state of Israel? To what extent does the Republic of Sudan recognize Jerusalem as the capital of the state of Israel?
We do not recognize it at all. The status of Jerusalem has been clearly identified as the haven of the three Abrahamic religions, and it has been put under certain tripartite authority, and this question should continue, and this status should continue. We do not accept that Jerusalem becomes the capital of the state of Israel. We are for a solution that would cater for peace and stability in the region while recognizing the rights of the Palestinian people for their own state. And I'm very happy to see, we are very happy to see that the new administration, the U.S. administration, the new U.S. administration has declared that it was also supporting the two-state solution. And that's exactly what we are advocating for. Concerning the Palestinians, for us now, we need really to think very carefully how we can help Palestine and how we can help the Palestinians. Can we help them by continuing the same policies of hostility that continued for 70 years without producing any positive effects? Or can we help them by adopting another attitude which would bring peace, stability, and reconciliation to the region, and which everybody will profit, and which the Palestinians themselves will thrive and be able to claim their rights, their rights in a kind of a pacified atmosphere, and where Israel and Israelis will recognize that peace and stability and giving the Palestinians their rights are in the interest of the state and people of Israel.
Ambassador Nuruddin, I know that you are an impeccable diplomat, plenipotential and extraordinary to boot. And this is really not a hypothetical situation. Is it reasonably possible that you could, in fact, recognize the state of Israel without recognizing its capital?
It is possible. It's quite possible. I think that we have to find a way of dealing with that. For the time being, that's the formal position of my government. We do not recognize Jerusalem as the capital of the state of Israel. We are now talking about the possibility of normalization with Israel. And when we come to the negotiations, we are going to put this on the table and see how we are going to deal with that.
Tell me, educate me a little bit about diplomatic niceties. Is it sincerely possible for one country to recognize another country without, in fact, having the implication that you also equally recognize the capital seat of that particular country?
I think it's definitely a very complex issue. I think what the ambassador said, however, shows how they can try to reconcile that and try to balance it. But I do definitely think it's very complex and points to, you know, a really long history that has a lot of, like I said, complexities. You know, this dates back to the Arab-Israeli war and, you know, Sudan choosing not to, you know, recognize or starting hostilities with Israel since then. So, you know, I think with the correct diplomacy in place, you know, it can happen. And what the removal from the state sponsors, the terrorism list, and the normalizing of relations as we see today shows a step in the right direction in terms of diplomacy.
Let me say that we are dealing with an unprecedented situation, an unusual situation. We need to be very creative about what we are going to do and think very carefully about it. We are talking to the Israelis, and we started talking to them about the possibility of normalization. We are not yet there. Mm-hmm. We are moving towards that. There are many hurdles to be removed. And my prime minister and leader of my state have said very clearly that this is a question that will be discussed by the legislative assembly, which is being formed now. In the process, we need to think very carefully about what kind of engagement we are going to have with Israel and what kind of things that we can accept and what kind of other things that are not acceptable to us. And this is what negotiations are about. And then, but the main objective is to move forward and find a settlement to the Palestinian problem and to the relations between Palestinians and Israelis and between Palestinians and Sudanese and other nations or countries that are involved in this crisis, in this problem that has been going for too long. The objective being peace and stability in the region while preserving the rights of the Palestinian people.
You know, when the transitional government of Sudan came into power, it said what happened was a fundamental change. And yet, there are a lot of critics who have actually been saying that in their view, not mine, what happened in the Sudan is not a fundamental change, but a change of guards. What are some of the most important challenges that the transitional government of Sudan is facing so far?
Well, I spoke about the economic issue, the financial issue, the livelihoods issue. I said, for me, this is the main problem. This is the major problem. Mm-hmm. Other problems are those pertaining, of course, to the reorganization of the state and the rebuilding the state on democratic basis, on equitable basis, resolving those issues that have been with us for too long, the issue of management of diversity that I mentioned earlier. We have also the issue of dealing with how are we going to move forward in a democratic on a democratic path while dealing with the legacy of the past. We have had totalitarian regimes in Sudan. We have a society that has been used and utilized in a certain way. we need to turn around this society and in order to really implement in a meaningful way the slogans of the revolution: freedom, peace, and justice. The major achievement in Sudan now is that there is freedom. People, when they walk in the street and when they express their opinion, they do not fear retaliation. And this is very important. We have known many authoritarian regimes in Sudan where people have been put to jail, have been tortured because of their opinion. This is not happening now in Sudan. And we see to it that it never happens again. For me, this is really the major achievement. The second thing is how to construct a new democratic, really democratic and meaningful democratic disposition in Sudan. And that's a real challenge, because we have to deal with forces that have been counter-revolutionary for so long and anti-democratic for so long in the society. And we are building that gradually. And we have plans for a constitutional conference that should be held before the end of the transitional period. And that this constitutional conference should address all these governance issues that we are grappling with.
You're watching Straight Talk Africa. We'll be right back with you. So please, don't go away.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Linoch Mudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
Welcome back to Straight Talk Africa, and today we are reflecting on the recent developments in the Sudan. My guests are Nuruddin Sati, Ambassador of the Sudan to the United States, and Temi Ibilogba, Program and Research Associate for the Africa Program at the Center for International Policy.
Talk to us about the experience, or at least the historical experience, that the Republic of Sudan has when it comes to democracy. At least I recall in my Sudanese history that there have been two very important democratic elections, one by one Sadiq Mahdi, who became prime minister and was twice overthrown by the military.
You know, the history of democracy and military coups in Sudan is a long one. Actually, it started, you know, Sudan started democratic elections, had democratic elections even before independence. 1953 was the first democratic election in Sudan.
Right.
It came with the government. That was during the self-rule, what we call the self-rule period in Sudan. We are familiar with that in our African countries, which were under British rule. From that, we had another election after independence in 56, and we had a coalition government that was put in place. But that government quickly was toppled in 1958. And I think that was the first military coup in Africa, if I'm not mistaken.
Not really. Even before. The first military coup, for your information, was in Togo, the one that overthrew Olympio.
Yes. Olympio was after that.
You may have a point, because for some strange reason.
I do have a point, because Togo became independence in 1960, my friend.
Togo is considered the first African coup against the
city. You know why?
Yes.
You know why? Because many people do not consider Sudan as being an African country.
You have a point. In fact, I was coming to the fact that, for example, your country regained her political independence in 1956.
Yes.
But when we talk about independence in Africa, we begin with the Republic of Ghana, which was 1957.
That's what I'm telling you. Well, if Sudan is considered an African country, it was the first country that regained its independence in January 1956. And in 1963, we became members of the OAU. We are founding members of the OAU. And then we had our first military coup in November, the 11th of November, 1958, Shaka.
Yes.
So it is the first military coup on the African continent.
You are right, you're right.
Yes.
Maybe there's a distinction between Africa and Black Africa.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm sorry. That's the problem that we need to deal with. To my mind, the OAU should have started on the right footing by dealing with socio-cultural issues before going into political issues.
I think you are right, because Africa historically has, in fact, been partitioned in three different parts. You talk about Africa south of the Sahara. You talk about Africa, you know, essentially north of Limpopo. You talk about North Africa, talking about Maghreb, you know?
Yes.
I think we need to get a way of simply looking at Africa as Africa. Now, let me ask you, Temi. The ambassador is talking about democracy, and indeed, democracy is probably the solution for most of Africa. Any particular reason why, for example, a lot of African leaders who run democratically challenged countries discredit the concept of democracy to the extent that, in fact, they ask their people if, in fact, they can eat democracy, that it is better for them, for example, to provide them with what they call service delivery and not necessarily democracy. How do you react to that?
I think, you know, like you said, there are leaders who are meant to be leading democratic nations, but, you know, they're staying in power for way too long, many years past their terms. They're changing constitutions and, you know, some acting undemocratically in nature. I think this is because of this business as usual approach that goes on the continent. So it's more beneficial to these leaders to stay in power and to not have the, you know, the peaceful transitions that they're meant to, because it's more beneficial to them. It's more beneficial to the people around them that they are, you know, doing nepotism with. So it's definitely a huge issue on the continent. We're seeing this kind of new generation of leaders who, you know, strong men who don't want to leave their positions. We just saw this in Uganda with Museveni. Bobi Wine, you know, was meant to be this hopeful young candidate who many people, who had the popular mandate that many people, you know, wanted to be in power, but unfortunately, you know, they weren't able to make that transition. So I think one of the main reasons is the shrinking of civil society space on the continent is why democracy isn't allowed to freely flow the way it needs to. And I think the U.S. definitely needs to hold a lot of these nations more accountable with their policy towards them. So say we're not going to give you military aid, you know, threaten the ending of, you know, development aid as well if, you know, if they don't abide by democratic rules the way they're meant to.
Is democracy and the service delivery mutually exclusive, or are they in fact mutually reinforcing?
I think that democracy should just be the default for countries. I don't think there should be any asterisks or, you know, requirements for it beyond that. This is just, we're following our constitution and democracy is the default for our society. So shady deals, different things that are incentivizing leaders to follow democratic ideals, that shouldn't be what's normalized. What's normalized should be the default of being democracy, the status quo being democracy, and peaceful transition to power.
What about you, Ambassador Noureddin?
I have answered that. The youth in the streets, even with the current difficulties, economic difficulties, and livelihood difficulties. When they go to the streets, they say in Arabic, "Ajur, ajur, walal kezan." They say hunger, hunger, rather than going back to the former regime of the Muslim Brotherhood. So they prefer to be hungry with freedom rather than to have the, you know, their delivery services satisfied, which were not satisfied anyway before that. So the answer is dignity and freedom and human rights are very important. For me, it's not a kind of binary, you know, thing, you know, question whether this or that. The question for me is how are we going to achieve delivery service within a democratic regime? And that's exactly what we are grappling with. That's most of our countries are grappling with. This is often used as an alibi to say, yes, stable regimes are better than democratic regimes, which is a fallacy to me. And now in Sudan, what we are saying, let us create a stable democratic regime that can deliver services to the people. And that's the formula in which we are working now. We do not ask ourselves whether it's better to have food without democracy or to have democracy without food or to have stability and all that. It is for us now to work together in order to see to it that delivery service delivery. And actually, yesterday there was a meeting in Khartoum at the top level on delivery service and how we deliver services to the people while continuing with our democratic agenda.
You can in fact have both, just like the Americans say, you can walk while at the same time chewing gum.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Interesting. Tell me, former U.S. President Barack Obama would seem, in fact, to agree with Ambassador Nuruddin because he once said that even prosperity without freedoms is in itself a form of fundamental poverty.
Of course, I think the lack of freedom of speech, freedom of voice, and freedom to move as you want in a state, these are all, you know, important elements. And if you're not given them, but, you know, maybe your economic is prospering or prosperous rather, you know, it's not a happy life for the people. You know, when you look at happiness, and you know what it means to live like a fulfilling life, you have to have, it has to have multiple aspects. It's not just economics, it's democratic freedom as well.
Interesting. Nuruddin, how do you respond to some supporters of the strong man syndrome who say that if you have a regime that stays in power for a long time, like your former president, Omar al-Bashir, stayed for about 3 decades, that in fact implies and should reflect, in their words, not mine, what they call peace and stability?
I beg to disagree, because the 30 years of al-Bashir regime have not given peace and stability to Sudan. They have given war and conflict and poverty. This is fallacious. It is not true that the mere fact that a ruler stays for 30 years, this will automatically, cause peace and stability for the country. At least from our own experience in Sudan, this has not been the case. On the contrary, the more a strong ruler stays in power, the more complicated become the problems of the country. They become intractable. The issue of peace of Sudan has been complicated. The issue of unity has been complicated. The issue of diversity has been complicated. The issue of welfare has been complicated. You know all the boxes that you can think of. You can see that they have not been ticked in the proper manner.
Tell me, is it reasonably possible to talk about peace and stability without the presence of social justice for all?
Yeah, I think that's a very important question, whether it's possible to have peace and stability without social justice. I don't think so. I think we've had a lot of case studies throughout the world where, even in the past year, where we're seeing social justice issues being brought up by the people. And because of this, there is this lack of peace and stability in this country because the people aren't happy. And as a result, they go to the streets, they protest, they make demands. So you can't really say your nation is peaceful or stable if there are these issues relating to social justice and human rights that the people are not happy about. There is going to be this feeling of being unsettled in the nation. We've had numerous case studies and examples of this throughout history. And like I said, in the past year, even with the Black Lives Matter movement we've seen in the United States, there is this sense of instability in the country, tension between different races and things like that. And that's because there are a lot of social justice issues that need to be rectified. And if we go to the continent as well, we can see this as well. MSARS in Nigeria, Zimbabwe and their protests that they had as well. So I think, definitely social justice has to be a number one priority. Listening to civil society voices has to be a number one priority if you want to have a productive society.
Nuruddin, what are some of the important lessons that other African countries can learn from your experience, especially when we talk about social justice? You look at the geographical location where the Republic of Sudan is located. In that general neighborhood, there's no one country that can boast on providing its people social justice.
Well, of course, social justice in our situation has been a long-standing dream and claim of the people. But unfortunately, our political class has not delivered on that since independence. And to my mind, and as Tim was just saying, social justice is at the core of the question of governance. A government that does not take care of the social justice and providing social justice and social services to its people, even if it stays for decades and decades, at the end of the day, the result will be total failure. So what are we talking about? We are talking about the people being satisfied that they are living in a free country, in a free society, that they are allowed to speak their mind and express their views, that their dignity is being respected, that the as a people together, they have a common goal to achieve, that together they look at for a brighter future for them and for their children, and that they are able to bring food to the table. So that all this together, and that, of course, those who feel that they have been marginalized for so long feel that they have their rightful place in the society, in the institutions of governance. And this brings me to the issue of institutions and strong leaders and all that. Rather than talking about the necessity of having a strong leader that stays forever, I think the most important thing is to build strong institutions that can withstand the pressures of time and the pressures of all the centrifugal forces that are trying to destabilize the country. So if you are able to build those institutions, then with the agreement of the people, and especially with those who have been marginalized for so long and who claim their rightful place at the table, and then you will be assured that you have nothing to fear and that you can call on the people and depend on the people to defend the institutions.
Institutions, strong institutions indeed. Tell me, to what extent do most Africans understand or know their relationship with the thing called the state or the government? Do most Africans really know their relationship with their governments?
So I think that's another very important question. I think the relationship between many African citizens and their governments is strained. And that's because of, you know, years of oppression, strongman politics, and all those things tie into institutionalism and systemic, laws and things that are in place that are very difficult to move. So a lot of citizens have a sense of voter apathy, a sense of just overall apathy that no matter what, their vote or their demands, what they want, isn't going to make a difference because there have been decades and generation long of, like I said, systems that have been in place that have not recognized them. So the way they see their relationship is very strained. It's not, in a way of, oh, I can go to my government and say I have this issue and, it will be resolved. It's one of just, feeling neglected and feeling like there's this loss of hope.
Ambassador, what about you? To what extent are the vast majority of Africans citizens or subjects? And in fact, what is the difference, as far as you are concerned, between a subject and a citizen?
I think there is a disconnect between the states and their citizens, as far as I'm concerned. And this has been going on for a very long time. And that's why, personally, I've always seen the governance issue as being an educational issue. You need to educate the people.
Civic about society?
The society.
Are you need to educate.
Civic education, of course.
Yes.
And that's why Mualimu in Tanzania is called Mualimu, which means the educator. So we need educators in at the helm of the state. The modern state has not yet, found its place in many parts of our countries. If I take the Sudan as example, there is a disconnect between the modern state and between the traditional state, which is still living its own life. And in many parts of the country, still traditional governance has to be taken in consideration if you have to, do you want to deliver anything? So this is another aspect. But the question about citizens and rulers, a citizen is a sovereign person. Mm-hmm. Who has full rights of citizenship, mm-hmm. Full rights of contributing to the major decisions, to choosing his or her own government and those who are going to govern her. Those who are being chosen will be answerable and accountable to that sovereign citizen. While as a ruler or a subject, is someone who is dictated upon in terms of livelihoods, in terms of values, in terms of views, in terms of ideas, in terms of choices, in terms of how that person sees him or herself and sees other people. So there is a big difference between the two, and that's exactly what we are dealing with in our African countries now.
And what sort of person did the Sudanese transitional government find in place in the context of Sudan when they toppled the former president, Omar al-Bashir?
They found a subject, of course. They found us a subject. And that's what the revolution in Sudan is all about, Shaka. It's about bringing, you know, full citizenship to Sudan and full rights of the people.
Tell me, this must be encouraging news from the new Sudanese authorities, because a citizen is the person that owes allegiance to the state. And for that, the citizen has a constitutional right. He is the primary stakeholder. He is the boss. Whereas a subject owes allegiance to an individual authority, who could be a king, a queen, a monarch, an emperor, or a presidential monarch. How do we resolve this issue? How can we solve this contradiction?
Yeah, you know, my last response was very pessimistic, you know, discussing, you know, the loss of hope. But case studies and examples like Sudan does give us hope. You know, it shows that if the people come together and have a revolution and stick to their demands as well, because the Sudanese people were very strong in what they wanted, and they refused to stop protesting and leave the ground until, you know, their requests were truly met and not haphazardly. They wanted the full thing done, you know. So revolutions is definitely one mechanism for receiving or creating change. Another, I think, is, you know, the youth and women. You know, in Sudan, women were the backbone of the movement, you know, and they have a way of going about things that has been very inspiring in a lot of movements throughout the world. So I think listening to women is very, very important. And, you know, Africa has the largest youth population in the world. So the youth are truly the future. They have, you know, Gen Zs, millennials have new, fresh ideas for, you know, how the world should be operated. They definitely think differently than, you know, the older generation as well. So I think, you know, listening to these people who are really the stakeholders, the youth are the ones that, you know, we're creating the world for them. So, you know, listening to what they think is important, and also educating them, bringing them into political spaces. You know, I think all of those things are very helpful in helping to shift the issues that we're seeing on the continent when it comes to, you know, democracy, social justice issues, etc.
The changing demographics, indeed, I might add, in tandem with the social media.
Exactly. Social media is another I was also going to mention. You know, a lot of these revolutions have taken place or started, you know, even the Arab Spring. I think the Arab Spring was a beautiful example that's helped to inspire, you know, protests and revolutions that we've seen since then. It shows the power to mobilize online and then come to the streets. And I think when done in tandem, you can see really amazing results.
On that note, Ambassador Nuruddin Sati and Temi, I have to say once again that it was a pleasure to host you on this special edition of Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Back.
Thanks to our audience for joining our conversation on Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not bitter, Africa. And please, please, let's keep the African hopes alive. Thank you.
Thank you.